All right, we're going to go this morning to talk about another influential character. It's a kind of a frontier thinker that I studied a lot in grad school, kind of some interesting things. George S. Counts. This is a little book that he wrote. He wrote several books, and most of them, you know, he wrote about four or five prominent ones, and I've read this one, and I've read about two of the other ones. They're about that thick, and they're dry as dust and not worth reading, so I don't recommend them. Obviously, I don't even recommend this as much, but very an interesting topic here, and George Counts was really in the 1920s and 1930s known as a frontier thinker. They had these three or four philosophers, if you want to call them that, education professors that taught at the Teachers College in Columbia and in the influential places, the teachers that taught the teachers. The teachers that taught those who would go out and write textbooks in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And you think, well, education was good back then. Well, it was a lot better than it is now, but they started making a lot of changes back then very subtly. We're going to discuss some of that here. But this book, just by itself, you can see the direction they're going. Dare the School Build a New Social Order. Dare the School Build a New Social Order. So the problems with America, we're going to look at some of them, and you're going to think we're talking about today. But this started about 100 years ago, 80 years ago, well, almost 100 years ago. And it just took them a while. Several generations of indoctrination, several generations of the textbooks pointing this, changing the curriculum slowly, convincing the teachers to reach for power and change society. And now the things that we are going to talk about today, like the evils of capitalism, you know, the mean evil capitalism where the people are getting rich and, you know, working hard and becoming wealthy. That's not fair. That's not right. We shouldn't have this. We need a new social order where everybody's equal. Sounds like today, doesn't it? This started back in the 20s and 30s. It took a long time for it to get where it is. And I wanted to go through some information about George Counts, really kind of some of his background. Didn't get really into his theory. I'm going to go through some of the background stuff kind of quickly, and we'll get to his theory and then talk about some of the influences that he had. Just real quick, a setting for him. He started college really in the early 1900s, about 1911. But during that time, you know, you were coming out of Reconstruction. That was post-Civil War. There was a lot of corruption after the Civil War. I don't know if you remember studying that in history. Some of you are probably like, history, what, I slept through that. Maybe you needed Mr. Brainerd to be your history teacher because he loves history and you would enjoy it. But Mr. Whitney was too busy, spitballs and all those kind of things. I'm sure he loved history. But if you think about, you know, Reconstruction and the carpetbaggers and the scalawags. You ever heard of all that? Is anything coming, ringing bells here? I know this is a rough crowd this morning. I got my work cut out for me today. So anyway, it was kind of a corrupt time in history, and there was a lot of back and forth. Obviously, you got people that were bitter. You know, they reached a settlement, the South surrendered, all those kind of things. There's a lot of hard feelings, a lot of issues, trying to heal the nation, come back together as one union, one nation. A lot of difficulty in that, you know, the ending of slavery, all that, the feelings that went along with that, all the varieties of the federal government control, all the feelings of that. The states kind of had to give up some of their rights a little bit. There's just a lot of difficulties, some corruption, some very prominent and weak presidents during this time. And then that led to the turn of the century, progressivism, and you see, you know, Theodore Roosevelt, one of the more famous presidents in history, and how they wanted to reform things, wanted to reform politics, reform everything that was going on, social arenas, economics, progressive, not necessarily in an evil sense of philosophy, but in an idea of we want to move forward. We want to put the Civil War behind us. We want to move forward and heal the nation, make some changes. And of course, that led to some philosophical things that were harmful to the nation. Then you had coming out of progressivism, things beginning to heal. You had some, you know, new inventions were beginning to happen in the you know, near the end of the 1910s into the 1918s, 20s, and all that started having, you know, the first beginnings of the automobiles and some industrialism and all those kind of things. Ford, you know, right? Ford is still going strong, not weak. Okay. I can't get anything out of anybody this morning. I'm just going to just keep it boring then, I guess. All right, here we go. So coming out then in the war, the Great War, and America was very helpful in the Great War. So you've got this sense of optimism. Wow, look, we were involved in this war. We did all those great things. We're healed as a nation. We helped the world defeat the whole situation there in Europe. And this optimistic, yay, we're going to do great. And then you started seeing businesses beginning to flourish and all this. And then what happened at the end of the 1920s? the Great Depression. And so that was used as kind of a springboard for people like George Counts to say, well, wait a minute, there's a problem here. Everybody, you know, people, the economy crashed and people lived in depression for several years. And, you know, you had the stock market people and people like, you know, committing suicide and jumping out of the windows and the Black Friday, all that. Not Black Friday, was it Black Monday? I can't remember. Is it Black Monday? Monday, thank you. I got confused with Black Friday. That's shopping, right? Okay, Black Friday. That's the fun one. Black Monday is the bad one. Okay, you gotta, Mondays are always bad, so we should be able to keep that in mind. But they have this sense of optimism and things, and then they have the Depression coming, and that's going to all factor into the philosophy and the mindset of George Counts. And that's the time period he grew up in. He's going to college, you know, from 1911, 1912, and 13. He's going to grad school, and he's beginning to be influenced by several people in college that are pushing for this societal reform. And I want to spend some time talking about some of the influences just real quick. There's the dates of his life. Again, he's known as a frontier thinker. There were several men. You probably never heard of them. One man was named Rugg. Kind of a crazy name. He got walked on his whole life. A man named Kilpatrick. Should I just stop trying? I guess. All right. Kilpatrick, Rugg, and Counts. They were really the frontier thinkers. And what does it mean when you think of frontier? You know, when I was a kid, I think of frontier. I'm thinking of all the westerns I used to watch with my dad, you know, Wagon Train, you know, the good stuff, the Rifleman. I just love that stuff, you know. My dad would get all excited. He's probably watched the same westerns 50 times, and he gets just as excited to time number 51. But, you know, you see moving out west, right? The frontier, the unsettled frontier, and all the hardships that are out there. But pushing forward and moving to new areas. Well, they wanted to do that philosophically and in society. We want to bring in a new frontier. Where, you know, America is you know, they got kind of lucky at the beginning. It just kind of worked out. And the American dream just kind of fulfilled itself. We'll discuss that in a minute. Just kind of naturally. They didn't really mean to. But now we've got these problems. We've got the rich people getting rich. We got the poor people being stuck in depression and these social classes. And it's really not good. And we need a new frontier to come to. And they realized that they couldn't do it the way the communists did. How do the communists do it? Yeah, hostile takeover, revolution, you go kill people if you have to. French Revolution type thing, whatever. Just go in there and you take all the people by force. He realized that wasn't going to work. We're going to talk about that. I'm getting ahead of myself. But we need a new social order, and we're going to do it quietly. We're going to do it quietly to where moms and dads in the home don't have any idea what's going on in the school, because mom and dad aren't going to be reading the textbooks. Mom and dad aren't sitting in the classroom. And so the generations of kids are growing up with this mindset. I would love one day, maybe I'm too opinionated, but I would love to just go sit, because I've heard all the stories, but I've never actually sat in, well, I have a couple times, but in a public school classroom. Now, I've talked to students that have been new to our school, like this year, for example, that tell me they didn't do anything. They don't do homework. They don't study. They sit around and they talk about social issues. And if you can solve a social issue problem, then you've learned. Education is social change, period, in the mind of the public school system. Now, we can keep our head in the sand and think that our kids are learning how to add and subtract, multiply and divide, but when they come to our school in the eighth grade and don't even know what subtraction is, but they can talk about climate change. But they can talk about, you know, we need everybody to be equal. They can talk about gender issues because that's all they're learning. And if they happen to have to use some type of mathematics to solve a social problem, wonderful. But they have no idea what they're doing. Are they learning? They're not learning what they need. They're learning about how to make a new social order. And we wonder why. We see what's going on in America today. Why suddenly people that couldn't vote last week because they're afraid of the virus are out in droves in the streets celebrating and drinking champagne after each other. Did y'all see that? That's hilarious. I've got Corona. Here, drink this. Just passing around random strangers. Suddenly it's a moot point and it's gone. But I better not get on that very much. But that's... We're going to go out and do what we want to do. We're going to bring social change. It's the most important thing ever. Because there's these mean capitalists that are greedy. and they're oppressing you. And if we don't change society to have everybody being equal, then we're going to fail and not have a country anymore in their mindset. So he was this very influential. He was a teacher at the Teachers College in Columbia. New social order coming in. In 1932 is when he wrote this book. It was his second or third book. A very small, short book. It's actually a compilation of some lectures. I'll tell you, the first time I read through this book, I was my jaw dropped. I just was in shock. This was 1932. 100 years ago, more or less. Not well, less, 90. I didn't do the math, Ms. Hobbs. I just couldn't believe what I was reading. It was like I was reading something that a liberal politician wrote yesterday. But this is what's been going on in the schools since the 1930s, very quietly. And we're going to bring this point out. You know what a silent revolution leads to? Silent revolution leads to violent revolution. Just real quiet. And we raise up generation after generation that have one goal in mind: social order, social change. And that the mindset is indoctrinated and changed here to where I can go out and I'm justified in the name of society and equality. I'm justified to destroy, burn, do whatever. I am fearful for this country right now. If in some weird, miraculous thing, I don't know if it's what the Lord wants or not. Now, it's okay to put 70 million voters on lists and call them racists and go after them. That's okay. But if it gets overturned, they will literally, like they say, they will burn this country down. Just imagine. Why? Because there was a silent revolution that happened for 80 years, and it's now turned into a violent revolution. That's unplain before our eyes. Now, and I've, Pastor and I just briefly talked about this, you know, it's bound to happen. I told him, I said, you know, we're going to lose religious liberty. One day we're going to lose it. Just never expected it in my lifetime, to be honest with you. That's what hurts. I was talking to Bill Farrington a little bit. You know, you always say, I feel for my kids when they... We've said that, you know, and we kind of say that, but now this is for real. this is really for real. I remember my dad saying, son, it's going to be hard for you. Well, it is harder for me than it was for him. We were facing things that he didn't have to face. But this is a whole nother level. And they've done it silently, just in the background, with men like this, changing the social order. Now, I want to talk about some influences of George Counts. Very, very interesting. You say, well, we're going to go through this quickly. I don't want to be, again, boring. Y'all are probably bored already. But he studied under a man named Charles Judd. You think, well, nobody's ever heard of Charles Judd. Charles Judd was one of the first people to push for this new branch of study. This was never a major in colleges until Charles Judd. He studied what was called educational sociology. Educational sociology, that education is responsible for altering and constructing society. Okay, that, you know, it's not anymore the home that influences the child to know what to do in the future, right and wrong. It's not the church that's going to influence them to do things or understand values or whatever. It's education. It's the school system, and in their mind, namely the progressive public education system, that must take up the task of changing society. Because after all, we can't trust these parents. You know, these parents might hold to some traditional values like the Bible. Or they might hold to some traditional value like right and wrong or basic morality, you know, about, you know, marriage or the sanctity of life and those kind of things. And have you seen over the past 90 years how they've destroyed that? Destroyed it. There's no sanctity of life in our country. The same people that believe abortion is okay will be the same people that will riot and loot in the streets and murder you and get away with it. Why? Because they don't value life. Why should they? You know, you hear these, it churns my stomach. I'm so glad we finally have a victory for reproductive rights. What are you talking about? Well, you didn't seem to have a problem when you were born. Where's your talk about reproductive rights then? But we've taken sanctity of life, just erase it. That doesn't matter. And so that's why we can do this in the street. We take sanctity of marriage and morality, and we eliminate that. And that's now, you know, transgenderism and all this LGBTQ whatever stuff. Yeah, that's hardly a blip on the radar kind of now. I'm not undermining it, but you know what I'm saying? It's not a major issue now because our society has accepted it. It's accepted it. That it's okay. We have eliminated the basic values that God established in the early part of the book of Genesis. We have destroyed them from society. From creation to life to marriage. God's ways. We've eliminated them through a silent revolution that then gets public. And as we're going to see, if I probably won't get there today, at the end, they make some bold statements that anybody that is against it, you must destroy any institution inimical, that is an enemy, anything that's an enemy to bringing in a new social order, you must destroy it. So we want peaceful togetherness, which, where was that for the last 4 years? We want peaceful togetherness. But if you go against us, suddenly peace is gone. They promoted that violence in 1932. We're seeing it play out in front of our eyes in 2020. And really, over the past 5-6 years, I remember our study we did, The Coddling of the American Mind. People don't get their way, they get angry. And they believe that they're justified to be violent because a silent revolution has happened in their minds. Well, this educational sociology, I'm getting way off track. Sociology, we're going to alter society. We're going to change it by changing young people. You know, I can't remember the exact wording in the statement. It was some Catholic or something that said it years ago. You know, you want to change a nation, give me the young people. Think about Hitler, what he did in the schools and all those, you know, they were ready to die the death for him. They were indoctrinated in it. Why do the Muslims teach this jihad to their children from the time they're born? Give them the youth. They'll follow it. They're indoctrinated in it. So they realize we can't change the adults, but through education, we can use that as a vehicle to change society through the next generations. Now, he did some scientific research on schools and on the progressive system that John Dewey that we talked about. He actually traveled with Judd. It was one of his, you know, these guys that do research, they get paid by the government to just research. And so they would take up surveys and travel and interview and watch schools and all those things and research the state of American public education. Well, George Kelts was his kind of assistant as he did his work, his research work, and he was heavily involved in all of that. And they came to the conclusion that, you know, they can actually construct society. They can be the ones who are really to reconstruct society. It was a scientific approach that your intelligence, man's journey for intelligence or education is responsible for changing society and even constructing it. So Counts was the first student. This was a brand new major. Educational sociology was a brand new major, and he was the first one to major in it at that university. And he participated a lot in Judd's work and traveled the country, his own scientific studies as well, which leads to the second influence, his own scientific studies. He did his own independent research. So Judd's philosophy and psychological approach and educational sociology approach came to Counts, who then went out and did his own research, and he wrote a book in 1922 called The Selective Character of American Secondary Education. I mean, I've read it, I've skimmed a lot of it and read some important points and things, but here's his main conclusion, okay? If you take the book, is thick, boring, don't read it unless you want to fall asleep. Here was his conclusion, that social barriers exist in our country. Social barriers exist in our country. So he did all this and he said that secondary schools, he studied the high schools, for example. And by the way, high schools, not everybody at this time went to high school. And some of y'all thinking, man, I didn't sign up for that, right, Jared? Get me out of here. That would have been great. But they said, oh, it's only the elite are attending the high schools. Only the special privileged ones are attending the high school. So we have this inequality, this gap. They love this word, the gaps. You know, gaps. There's a poverty and rich. There's a gap there of wealth. There's a gap of because of race. There's a gap. And there's a gap over here because of gender. You know, for all the talk about coming together, it's some of the most divisive language you've ever heard. It's just, you're just adding to the division by promoting some concept of a fake gap that doesn't exist. I don't know, but in my experience, I don't see any gap in America. Because we've been able to have freedom and liberty to this point, you can go and work as hard as you want to. If you want to work 90 hours a week, you can. And you can do well in America. In America, you can start on the bottom and work your way up in a company, for example. But that requires work. We want stuff handed to us. So therefore, we blame it on a gap that I didn't have the same opportunity as somebody else. And it's really caused a lot of destruction. So these high schools are only benefiting the wealthier class and making those students come out, and then they have all the opportunities and they can have all the success in college and they can go out and make all the money in a capitalistic system. So we need to remove capitalism and bring in a socialistic system where everybody has the same opportunity and everybody's given. So take from the rich, give to the poor, bring both together like this. The rich people come down and the poor people come up. And you know that that's a complete failure. We don't have time to get into that. But what's going to happen? The people that work hard and make the money, they're going to say, what's the point? Why should I go out there and kill myself if the government's just going to take it and give it to little dude over here? So why don't I just stop working and be the little dude, the poor guy, and I'll just get free money? That's what we have in America right now in some ways in our tax code. It decentivizes people to be independent and to work hard. It decentivizes them. And so everybody's just going to be a lazy, so to speak, just don't do anything and then depend on the government to provide for you. But it's interesting, who gets richer? The people in power. I thought we wanted equality. I thought we wanted to be on the same social footing, but we got these social barriers. Now, it's interesting, another influence that he had was, believe it or not, you know, we hear all this talk the past 4 years of Russia, Russia, Russia. Well, here's your Russia. He actually went to Russia, visited there for 8 months, did his grad work there and all these kind of things, and he did his economic research on, wow, what is Russia doing? And he was so enamored with this communistic society and how they were able to do all this. But he actually disagreed with one thing in the communists. As he studied Russia, he saw Stalin's five-year plans and all those things. The plans have been instituted to force the nation to build a collective economy with specific goals for each industry. And, you know, we're going to have a collective system, socialism. We don't have time to get into all that. But what he said is he didn't agree with the way they took over, which was violence. He knew that in America, in the 1920s and 30s, it would never stand. He knew it. And so he literally said, well, we don't want to do what they did. We want to eliminate class, okay, like Marxism. You eliminate class. We don't need rich, poor, no middle class. We just need, you know, one level where everybody feels good about themselves. Just one level, except the rich politicians. They have everything they want. But he said, I don't approve of Marx's revolutionary and violent methods, because he knew that would never stand in America. People would fight back. So he realized, I can't do it Marx's way. So I'm going to propose, as we've already said, a silent revolution. We can't go out and just force people to do this, but we can change the minds of kids. And it may take 4, 5, 6 generations. It may take 40, 50, 60, 100 years, but we're going to get there. Visionary. And I dare say we're there. That supposedly 70 million people in this country, supposedly, support socialism. I never thought we'd see the day in my lifetime. Never did. But it's here. And so they'll continue the same steps. He was influenced by Russian communism. He was influenced by that socialist or sociology for education. And so with all of that combined, near the end of the 1920s, one more thing happened that we've already talked about, that just in his mind, proved him to be correct. And what was that one thing? Great Depression. Okay? So he's already talked about all this. He's already seen how Marxism would work. He's already seen in his mind the evil of classes, the evil of capitalistic rich people, and, you know, the poor guy just struggling, you know. So here's some of his books that he wrote, American Road to Culture, and Education and Social Construction is the theme of that. Let's talk about that real quick. So when the market crashed and the depression resulted, and educators said, we need to focus in teaching these kids, not just on the three R's. We don't need that stuff anymore. We need to teach our kids about business and politics. That's what they need to know so that we can prevent this Great Depression from happening again. And we need to train these kids through our textbooks and through what we teach them in the classroom of what is the best political way. What is the best, you know, this business, you know, we don't capitalism. I mean, you know, these, think about it, and they word it so appealing. You know, how do you feel, kids, if, you know, little Susie over there had $50 and you have zero and she goes into the lunchroom and buys 45 ice creams and eats them all herself? Isn't that just sad? You deserve some of that ice cream. Well, little Susie, worked. Maybe she like hemmed clothes or something, and she worked in her community and she worked really hard and she made extra money. If little Susie wants to take her $50 that she earned and go buy ice cream, then let her buy the ice cream. But that's not fair. It's not fair. Why do they have to then have all these things in our country? You know, everybody's got to have the same thing so nobody gets their feelings hurt. It's the mind, it's all there in that mindset. Now, they would never say that or admit that, but that's where it comes from. Your feelings got hurt. It's those mean capitalists. You know, I joke with Isaac. Isaac has an F-350 Lariat, and I want one. Well, Isaac worked his rear end off to get that Lariat. And if Isaac wants to go buy a Lariat, he can go buy one. Great. I'm happy for you, because I get to ride in it sometimes, and I get to drive in a few times. Pretty cool. He made money, and I didn't. It's not fair. It is fair. You have the same opportunity in this country. You just don't want to work for it. Let's get down to brass tacks of what it really is. But they don't like this because that divides people. I'm driving a 2002 F-150. Mine's still a Lariat. I'm driving a 20-year-old Lariat. Isaac's got a new one. Makes me feel bad. That's really the mindset that they want these kids to have. Oh, those corporate people up there. Oh, they made. Wow, his bonus alone was $5 million. Well, maybe he started out when he was 20 years old and worked his fingers to the bone to build that company, and he can enjoy the profits. But we don't want that. So The Road to Culture, this book, in the 1930s, he wrote this, coming out of the Depression. We've got to fix this problem. We can't have this, you know, running these classes like this and hurting everybody's feelings, and then the Great Depression happens. We want this Road to Culture. So what he was doing, he was challenging in this book. He challenged educational leaders, and he says, hey, we've got to change what the education does. We can't do the status quo. He actually said this. He said, if the status quo is maintained, the system of education will lack direction, and the theory of education will reflect the drift of the social order. And we don't want to have what we've got now. We want to change to something new. Well, it seemed like nobody was taking his call that he made in 1930. Nobody was rising to the challenge to change education. He said, you know what? Then I'm going to do it. And so then he wrote, Dare the School Build a New Social Order in 1932. Now, again, coming out of the calamity of the Great Depression, he feels like he has a soapbox to stand on, or he's got a leg to stand on, because here I've got, you know, look at the evils of capitalism that, you know, just left the markets crashing and all those kind of things. And so he wrote, Dare the School Build a New Social Order. Now, he, again, just quickly some things that he discussed here. First, he said, well, we still need faith in education, believe it or not. He was like, you know, we have always trusted the process of education. And again, he's promoting education pretty highly. And he even said that progressive education is valuable. Progressive education, we talked about with John Dewey. He said it's valuable, but he did have some problems with progressive education that we want to point out here in just in this next slide. So here's progressivism. Here's the three things about progressivism that he promoted. John Dewey did. John Dewey would say the child is good, okay? The child doesn't have a sin nature. He's already good. You just help lead him along and he'll figure it out on his own. And education is intellectual. He's using his mind and learning some things, and it prepares you for social adaptation. In other words, that you, this is progressivism, that you as the child, you can adapt quickly to whatever the culture brings at you or whatever society brings at you. Well, Counts is saying that's not good enough. The child shouldn't adapt to what society does. The child should dictate and change and make society what he wants it to be. Instead of just being, well, okay, we're capitalistic, we'll just deal with it again, you know, we'll just, you know, it's okay, we'll make it through. No, you need to get out there and change it. You know, revolutionaries are very bold. They don't step back. They don't rest. They don't stop. They push forward with their mindset. So he said progressive education is the best method that we have right now for social warfare, but, you know, it emphasizes child-centeredness. Remember we talked about that the teacher just lets the child decide what they want to do and it just kind of guides him along the way. Well, that emphasis on child-centeredness neglects something. It ignores social change, social training. The child needs to see himself. Yeah, he can dictate what he wants to know, but he needs to see himself as a broader part of society. And he said progressivism failed to do that. He can follow his interests, he can follow his experiences, and he can develop qualities that he likes. But many times, Count said, the problem with that is then the kid restrains himself from going outside of his social class and attacking social injustices. You know, that's a huge thing today. Everybody thinks that, you know, social injustice is the absolute worst thing possible. For there to be an injustice. For there to be an unfairness. For there to be an unequality. That's just the worst thing you could think of. So here, just, you have to be able to take that child and show them. And here's his counteract to that. The child is good, sure, but the child is neutral, is what he would say. And because of that, education can stir a social passion to change society. And here's his quote or statement from the book. Imposition. Now, that's a little different than progressivism. Progressivism says, John Dewey, that you just hands off. Okay, child, you want to do this, you want to learn about that, you go learn it. You figure it out what works for you. Pragmatic. We talked about that the last couple times. Here he says you actually have to impose something in education. Now, actually, I mean, I agree with that. I agree with that. We impose at Santa Rosa Christian School biblical values. You can call me a child abuser or whatever else you want to call me. Mean, not let them have freedom of thought, whatever. We want to impose the Bible. We want to impose truth. It's a deliberate effort to do that. If you don't do it in the home, then something else will impose on them. I've said that many times. Something else will. Sadly today, social media will. There's a lot out there. The philosophies of the world will. Their friends will. Is that who we want teaching our kids and imposing on them? Somebody's going to impose. Well, Count said the teacher has to impose, but he must impose the definition of good on students so that students know how to construct a good society. So now the teacher is the one in charge of determining what is good and imposing that on society. Now, let's take a step back from that. Back in the 1930s, 40s, and maybe even up to the 50s, a lot of teachers, and this is just a generic statement, this is just what I think, still had a sense of morality. You know, some of you probably went to the public schools back in the olden days. And, you know, there were teachers, I'm sure, that wanted values, right? I mean, they'd pull out the paddle and whop you right there in the classroom. You don't cheat. You don't lie. You don't steal. This is right. This is wrong. And they were imposing their mindset of good. And what Count said is we've got to change the teacher's mind first. So all the things that we're going to see that he wrote in the teachers' colleges, all the things he taught, is to change the teacher's mind of what is good. See, and then notice what happened about the 60s. What happened at Carolyn in the 60s in education? Took the Bible out. Why did they do that in prayer? Why? Because the Bible was imposing what was good. We can't have that. That's something objective. We need the teacher to decide what he thinks is good for society and impose that on the kid. So in the 60s, this all led. It took 30 years. Get the Bible gone. Yes, got rid of that. We're one step closer. Now just let the teacher come up with their own conclusions, come up with their own mindset. And then it took several more years or decades to get rid of those teachers that still follow the Bible. You know, we got to get rid of them. And so we just keep moving more and more of the Bible out. And you can see how it takes time. Over just the process of time, slowly but surely, a silent revolution to the point now where the teacher's the one that has a new duty. Here's a famous, you've probably never heard this, but if you've studied education, there's a famous quote from his book. That the teachers should deliberately reach for power and make the most of their conquest is my firm conviction. Now, we hear a lot about empowering, right? Reaching for power. Got to get power. He said, teachers, you have to realize something. You have power over these kids. And that is true, isn't it? It's natural. They're in the classroom with a teacher all day. The teacher's going to have the ability, the power, if you want to call it that, to influence those children. And what he's saying is, you have to decide what is good for society, namely the destruction of classes, total equality, multicultural, just all of the stuff that we've seen for the past 20, 30 years. The teacher's the one that can do this. Reach for the power. That's your new duty, is to change society, to get rid of capitalism, because mom and dad aren't going to tell them that. The church isn't going to tell them that. So it's our job as these teachers to do this. So to be a influence of not just intellect, but again, they want a new definition of education that gets into business and politics. So the new influence is social attitudes, social ideals, and social behavior. What is your attitude going to be to society and your fellow men? What are the ideals of right and wrong in society? And as we're going to see later, equality is right. Anything that separates classes is wrong. Anybody that goes out and makes money and is wealthy, he's evil. That's what we've seen happen. Now, we don't have time to get, we'll finish this one last one. That we saw his influence, the duty, the influence, and now the teacher's new emphasis. That society no longer needs political structure. Society needs economic structure. And what does that mean? Get rid of all the different levels and classes and just have one baseline, one class. Everybody on the same footing. And here's one last thing, and we'll come back to this next time. We hold within our hands, this is what he quoted in the book, the power to usher in an age of plenty, to make secure the lives of all. Whose job is it to secure your life? Bible tells me that if I don't work and provide for my family, I'm worse than an infidel. It's my job to provide for my family and secure things for my family. We've laid that responsibility down. It's the government. We've got to be able to bring in an age in which the government is going to secure the lives of all, unless you disagree with them. Side note. And to forever banish poverty from the land? Because we've seen that work in history. I've been thinking about Jeremiah and all that we preached in there. You know, the Lord gave the people rest under Josiah. And then the very next king, the people were right back to their ways. I was talking to Kevin Gower. He said, you know what? Maybe we aren't trusting God enough. And God's going to see, how are you going to trust me now? It's a harsh thing to think about. they did this. The Lord's in it. The Lord brings things to a conclusion. He rises and falls. We hate to see it. It's grieving. It's disappointing. I hate seeing the prosperity of evil. I feel like Asaph, you know, when he's like, I'm angry because the evil people are doing all this stuff and getting away with it. Remember that? In Asaph, and then he said, then when I went up to the temple of the Lord, I figured it out. Same thing happened to Habakkuk. We need to go read that again. Lord, why are you letting these Babylonians get away with this evil, destroying our land? Because you sinned. But don't worry, I'm going to bring it all back together and I'm going to return. You just keep trusting me. That's hard. It's a hard pill to swallow. Hard. But we have to trust the Lord. I'm way over. I apologize. We'll pick up here next time. Father, just thank you for the fact that you're still in control and that you know the end from the beginning. We continue to trust you, Lord. We're grieved. We're saddened at the direction our country's going in. We thank you for the times of religious liberty that we've had. But Lord, if things get tough, persecution happens, help us to keep on going and get tougher. Continue to do your work until you come. In Christ's name we pray, amen. Thank you. Sorry for going over.